Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. This week the discussion is all about kidneys. My first guest is Fiona Loud, Policy Director of Kidney Care UK, and she has significant skin in the game.
So I received my kidney from my husband 19 and a half years ago. And so now he has one and I have one. And they both carried on working independently for all of these years. But I should say that transplantation, like dialysis, is a treatment. It's not a cure.
She talks about how kidney health is often overlooked, what the problems can be and what they can lead to, and now also how to avoid poor kidney health. Then another way to treat kidney cancer.
So as the ice ball grows, we can see it in the CT scanner and we can see the tumour, and we can be confident that the ice ball gets bigger than the tumour and destroys it inside of the patient.
Dr. Alex King is a consultant radiologist and tells us all about his work in freezing tumours in the kidney. So please do stay tuned for a great show. Thank you. So over to my first guest, Fiona Loud, Policy Director at Kidney Care UK.
Thank you very much, Mike. Just before I start, I'd just like to say that Kidney Care UK is partnering with Boehringer Ingelheim on this awareness campaign to shine a light on chronic kidney disease. And the views I'm sharing today are entirely my own as a representative of Kidney Care UK. We are the UK Kidney Patient Support Charity.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Now, you work for Kidney Care UK, but you've got a very personal interest in kidney health and kidney disease.
Yes.
In that you were a sufferer. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to get involved.
Yeah. So I suppose what I would say is once a sufferer, always a sufferer. It's chronic, which means that it doesn't go away. So for me, I've actually got a genetic condition, which wasn't detected until we wanted to have children, to be honest with you. And I had a bit of a crisis when I was going to give birth to my daughter. And through that, I discovered that I had not just chronic kidney disease, but I also had a genetic condition, which is what led to it. And I also had kidney cancer. So all of those things came together through my life and meant eventually that I was able to have two lovely young children. But I spent 5 years on dialysis, which is a very challenging situation. But I've been fortunate enough to receive a kidney. It'll be 19 and a bit years ago now from my husband, which has kept me well and sent me back to work in order to be able to change the world, talk about kidney disease and make things better for people who are either at risk of it or living with it at the moment.
Goodness me. So you really went through the mill, didn't you?
Yeah, all of the things, I'm afraid. And it was it is very, very challenging. And that's why I would very much like to enjoy this conversation. We can talk about some of the things we can do to avoid kidney failure if at all possible, but at least look after what can your listeners do to prevent kidney disease deteriorating as well. Because for some people, I had a genetic condition, I had some particular problems, that was challenging. But for many people, kidney disease, if you detect it, can be managed. And what we're saying is there's a bit of a gap here. There's sort of a missing piece in finding out that you've got kidney disease itself, because it's much larger than you think.
I'm going to make sure we have a good chat about that and you have many opportunities to tell people about that. But I just got to touch on the fact you mentioned you got a kidney from your husband.
I did, yes.
All right, so
that's right.
What a wonderful thing. And also, what are the chances of that? Because not anyone can just give anyone else a kidney.
No, we were fortunate that we had similar blood groups and then we sort of had, we were a reasonably good match as well. So Not everyone's able to make that match. So there are other ways of doing it. If my husband had been happy to donate to me, but I hadn't been a match, there's something called it's sort of like the kidney matching system. So you can go into like a pool and you can find somebody else. So through the pool, there might be somebody else who's also incompatible with their potential donor. And so I could receive the other person's kidney and Keith could give his kidney to that other person.
Okay.
So we have this, it's called a sort of match, a shared system or a matching system.
So it's more than just blood type. It's got
tissue type.
Can you quickly just say what a match is? What defines a match?
Yeah, so there are basically a number of genetic markers, blood markers, should I say, and enough of those need to match to make sure that you are not going to immediately reject that other person's kidney that's given to you. So there are some blood groups that are opposite to each other. For example, I'm not the expert particularly on that, but we had both compatible blood groups and compatible tissue types, which meant that he was able to donate directly to me, for which I'm enormously grateful. And yes, I do. I never forget about it, even though it'll be 20 years at Christmas, actually, Mike. So it's quite a big anniversary coming up for that.
And you're looking great on it, I have to say.
Well, thank you. And I know this is radio, so no one can see that. But thank you.
They're just going to have to take appreciated. My word for it.
Appreciated, for sure.
All right. So, I mean, fascinating story. I'm sure we could talk about that a lot more, but we should move on to sort of kidney disease in general, chronic kidney disease. How many people actually have it?
So about 1 in 10 people in the UK have some stage of chronic kidney disease. So about 7.2 million people, about half of those will be at the earlier stages. And the other half will be in a sort of moderate to later stage condition. So it's more prevalent than many people think.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is loads of people, 1 in 10.
Yep. And it's quite harmful. So actually, we really want to shine a light on that and talk to people about how that we want to get more people detected with the condition and offered advice and guidance about what they can do about it.
All right. Well, let's look at sort of detection and symptoms, because you said a lot of people are undiagnosed. So
about a million people don't know that they have it.
Okay. So, well, I suppose, what's the problem? Does it matter? And how can you potentially find out if you've got it? What things might you notice?
So kidney disease is largely a silent condition. So many of the signs of it, you know, are quite nonspecific at the earlier stages. So, for example, being very, very tired, feeling quite nauseous. In the later stages, your legs, your ankles start to swell up a bit as well. And you get very puffy eyes, for example. You may actually at first urinate a lot, and then gradually, if you come to kidney failure, many people actually stop urinating. So that is quite a noticeable thing. But that would be at the far later stages, and you should be picked up by then. Sometimes people can be blood in their wee. I know that can also be a sign of cancer. So that can be another sign, or sort of foamy wee as well. So there's these kinds of signs. Also, you can become incredibly achy as well, and you get very, very low iron. But again, some of those things can be signs of other mm-hmm. conditions as well. So they're not, it's quite silent until it really gets towards the end, which is why it's really important to have yourself tested for kidney disease much, much earlier if you might be at risk.
Okay. You mentioned achy. Is that achy all over or sort of lower back? Kidney area?
Yeah, you can feel very achy all over. Achy all over your body, because actually one of the things the kidneys do is they regulate your blood pressure, but they regulate your bones as well. And so if your kidneys aren't filtering as well as they should, your blood pressure starts to go up, your heart has to pump harder. But also if you're not working as well as they should, they're not excreting some of the toxins that we naturally take in throughout the food and drink that we have. And that can end up, you get things like start to itch, especially across the middle. So actually, it's not that you don't really get any particular feeling in your kidney area, organs, just behind the back, just behind the sort of the small of the back, if you like. And I'm waving my arms around, which again, listeners won't be able to hear, won't be able to see rather. But we've got lots of information about it on our website, which is kidneycareuk.org.
Okay. All right. So we've got some potential symptoms. If people are maybe experience some of these symptoms, or even if they don't, perhaps they're in a group of people that might be more likely to get this.
Yes.
What you know, what can they do? Is there a kidney test they can take?
There is absolutely a kidney test. And I'll come back in a minute to the people who are more likely to have this condition.
Yeah.
But actually, there is a kidney test. It's a blood test and it's a urine test. And you can get those tests at your GP practice. But you do need to ask very specifically to have a kidney test. So they're very simple, straightforward tests. And they will give you a diagnosis. But what I should say is that the kinds of people, Mike, who might have this condition or more likely to have chronic kidney disease are people with diabetes and people with high blood pressure, but also people with a family history of kidney disease. So those are some of the sort of alerts that people should be thinking about. Have I got these conditions and am I getting regular kidney checks for them? So, for example, for people with high blood pressure, we have some data that shows that only about 30% of people with high blood pressure actually get regular kidney checks. And that's something that should be that should be improved because it's a clear, you know, pointer for danger to your kidneys. Yeah.
Okay, this is interesting for me personally, because I have high blood pressure, right? But I take tablets to keep it down. Mm-hmm. And I also make sure I do a reasonable amount of exercise, which also keeps it down. So if you take my blood pressure, generally you think, right, he hasn't got high blood pressure, but I'm doing things to try and keep it down. So do I come in that group of people with high blood pressure just because I'm doing something to try and keep it down?
Right. Well, I mean, obviously, I'm not a medical practitioner, so you'd have to ask
it's probably
GP.
Probably an unfair question.
for all of that, to be honest with you, but what you have touched on though is that one, you know, you have high blood pressure. So, and if it was unmanaged high blood pressure, generally speaking, you'd recommend to go to your doctor and say, you know, can I get a kidney check? Can I get this checked out as well? But secondly, the kinds of things that you've just talked about, like eating well, taking some exercise, those are things which are both good for your kidneys, but very good for your heart. So they are good overall for your cardiovascular system, and they will make a difference to your health of your kidneys, the health of your heart, or the health of your overall body as well. So they are definitely good things to do. So eating well, avoiding as many, lower salt, lower sugar, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so you mentioned a couple of things there, which sort of comes on to another question. What can we do to avoid it? So you mentioned exercise, eating well, that's good for, everything. Is there anything else specifically that's worth not doing if we maybe fall into one of these categories, our parents had it or what have you?
Yeah. So there's a few things to mention. I mean, one is keep well hydrated. So 6 to 8 glasses of water a day, that kind of thing. And you'll be able to tell if you're well hydrated, because your urine would be a sort of pale yellow straw type colour. The next thing that you can do, we've already talked about sort of eating well and doing some form of exercise. There's not smoking. So smoking itself doesn't just cause lung cancer, it can also cause kidney cancer. So, and actually, it frankly increases your risk of cancer by about four times or something. So it's something like, it's really high additional risk to you and your health. You can also take care not to eat ultra-processed foods. I was just sort of speaking about that. Take them as a treat rather than as part of what you normally eat. Yeah. And try and do, I'm certainly no dietitian, but it makes sense to try and have those 5 a day if you can. But things like adding fruit to cereals and frozen food, frozen vegetables, tinned vegetables, they all count actually in terms of just building up the bulk of what you eat, but also keeping you healthy. And in fact, I should say, if you don't mind the small advert, that Kidney Care UK, we have this fantastic resource called the Kidney Kitchen. And it offers loads of different recipes for people from all sorts of different backgrounds with healthy food, healthy eating. But if you have offer advice about the type of thing you should eat with that.
Okay, excellent. So you've spoken about some ways to try and avoid it. What about some of the things that it can potentially lead to? You know, if you have, because you can have this problem for, it appears for, years without realizing it. So what sort of things can kidney problems lead to? What can you expect if you're a sufferer from kidney disease? How might you experience it such that it starts to cause real problems in your life?
So, at the earlier stages, well, I think we've already established that the kidney disease can be quite harmful, but detecting it earlier and being given the kind of advice that we've just talked about around lifestyle is incredibly important. But if the disease does progress, which unfortunately in some people it does, then eventually it can lead to further heart problems. Your blood pressure will go up, as we've already discussed, which can make you feel quite dizzy, for example, and quite unpleasant. And actually, eventually, if unchecked, can lead to kidney failure. And kidney failure means then your choices really are dialysis, which is quite a challenging experience. I've spent 5 years on dialysis myself, so I can describe it if your listeners are interested in that, but it is difficult.
Do that. I mean, how often do you have to go in for dialysis? Is it a daily
So,
thing?
yeah, so if you have dialysis in a hospital, that's 3 times a week, about 4 hours at a time, with time to get to the hospital, time to wait, and then time for it's effectively 2 needles that go into you, into a special vessel that's usually made in your arm. Or just beneath your sort of your what's it called, your clavicle, it's in the jugular vein, and what that will do is the blood will be pumped out of you through some rubber tubing into a machine, which will then cleanse your blood, remove the toxins, remove the fluid that your native kidneys are no longer able to remove, and then it'll just go around in a circuit back into your body, and that process takes a number of hours and needs to be done regularly in order to keep you sort of maybe 10-15% of what a normal person's kidney function would be. So it's quite a, it's quite a difficult process. Some people are able to, have quite a few years on dialysis. But if you are well enough, you will also be able to go onto the transplant waiting list. And then if you, but you do need to remain well enough because that is a major surgery as well. And then if you're fortunate to do that, you'll then be able to receive somebody else's kidney, and that could be somebody who has passed away, and has given permission for their organs to be reused, or somebody. About one third of our transplants come from living donors. So I received my kidney from my husband 19 and a half years ago, and so now he has one and I have one, and they both carried on working independently for all of these years. But I should say that transplantation, like dialysis, is a treatment. It's not a cure. And that's why we are at Kidney Care UK working very hard to raise awareness of the earlier signs of kidney disease. Because if you know about it sooner, you can get advice from your doctor, your practice nurse, and you can take some of the more straightforward lifestyle type of changes that we've already discussed here.
Okay. Let's for just a moment explore the link a bit more between kidney problems and heart disease or cardiovascular disease.
Yeah.
Is there more to it than just the high blood pressure? And how many people that suffer or die from CVD, is that brought on by kidney problems? Does anyone
So,
know?
well, the data that I can be sort of clear on here is that most people with kidney failure will die of heart problems, cardiovascular problems. So,
Okay.
and so kidney disease is damaging to your heart function as well. So we used to do this kind of this phrase, which was, if you look after your kidneys, you look after your heart. So the two are very much hand in hand. So if you put too much pressure on your blood vessels, then they can start to calcify. You could start to get build up blood clots as well, which will make it even harder to pump the blood around. And then the heart, gets sadder and sadder as it's trying to push the blood around your body and keep your body well oxygenated. So clearly, if your kidneys aren't functioning, because as I say, they regulate so much of your body, and it puts that pressure on your heart. But also, if your heart's not working very well, it means that those two, one is a risk multiplier for the other.
It's a surprise that people hear about being kind to your heart, be healthy, look after your heart, but rarely do people say be healthy, look after your kidneys.
I know. I know, and we do think that kidney disease does need that light shine upon it, because it's up to 1 in 10 people are affected by it. So it's much more prevalent than people understand. But if you know about it, there's simple steps that you can take to help you. And what I should say, Mike, is if people want to know more about what their kidneys do and how to look after them, we've got a fantastic campaign we're running at the moment, which is called the Bloody Amazing Kidneys campaign. And so on our website, kidneycareuk.org, just if you Google Bloody Amazing Kidneys, you'll be able to find it as well. That is a simple health checker and it's free of charge. You don't have to give away any personal information at all. And you can just go in and it will ask you some simple questions like your age, your blood pressure, what size you are, because actually obesity itself is also linked to kidney disease. And it will ask you some other things about, do you have diabetes and family history, that kind of thing. And it will come out, it takes about 4 or 5 minutes to fill out, and it will come out with something that will either way you can get some more information about kidney health, reflecting some of the things we've talked about today. But it will also give you an idea if you might be at risk of kidney disease itself. And what we've found, in fact, we just reached, I think it was yesterday, 310,000 people have now taken that online health check since we first launched it late 2024. And about half of the people who've taken the health check are at potential risk through high blood pressure. So we are encouraging your listeners to go in and just take the test, because you might get some information. You will get some useful information, and then you might get something that tells you a little bit more about what you could do about that.
Okay. Does it then give people a good nudge to go and, well, improve their lifestyle, but if necessary, call the GP?
Exactly so. So rather than just go straight to the GP, here's a simple step that you can take. And what it will do is, if you want, it will download a letter for you that you can then take to your GP if you then go in there and ask for a kidney test, the blood and urine test, diagnosis. And so that's why I would say that it's one small but simple test or check that people could make. You might want to do it after this discussion, Mike.
Extremely useful. Yes. Give the website for that one more time, please, Fiona.
Yeah. So on kidneycareuk.org, we have the Bloody Amazing Kidneys Health Checker. But actually, just Google Bloody Amazing Kidneys and it will take you to our website and to the right page to take the health check.
Excellent. Look, Fiona, thank you very much for taking the time to chat about this, because, it affects a lot of people, 1 in 10 of us. So many thanks.
That's a pleasure, Mike. Thank you.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Imagine. Every day, clients walk into your office with their concerns about intimacy, identity, desire, and trauma. Questions that require more than basic training. Emotional and sexual dynamics are evolving, and today's professionals must evolve with them. We hear from parents unable to start conversations with their children around identity. Too often, adolescents have learned their sexual ideas from the internet. Couples have difficulty communicating about sex with each other. At the International Institute of Clinical Sexology, you can gain the specialized skills and knowledge to address those issues with confidence. Whether you are a therapist, coach, educator, or other healthcare professional, our advanced certifications and PhD program empower you to become a highly skilled, sought-after sex therapist. Expand your expertise. Elevate your earning potential. Start your journey today with the International Institute of Clinical Sexology. Imagine making a difference in our world. Learn more at clinicalsexologyphd.org.
Apples and pears, beef and skittles, cider with Rosie, common or garden, Ant and Dec, fish and chips, mum and dad.
UK Health Radio and Health Triangle magazine. Each is good by itself, but enjoying both is always better. Add Health Triangle magazine to your monthly health regime. Check it out at ukhealthradio.com.
Strawberries and cream.
Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
The next guest is Dr. Alex King. He's a consultant radiologist. He was talking about another way to treat kidney cancer. But my first question to him was just how common is kidney cancer?
Well, kidney cancer is reasonably common in the UK. We expect to see about 13,000 cases a year, but it's a real wide variety. There are some cases that are very localized just to the kidney, which are clearly the ones that I deal with as a radiologist. But then some people will present with much wider spread disease or much more locally aggressive disease. And that's often managed in a way that I can't always help with. But the important thing is that because we're now scanning people more often, we're finding these small kidney cancers more and more frequently. So all of the patients that I treat would have had a scan for something else, for a gallstones or a bad back or something else. And it just happens to have thrown up a small kidney cancer. And then we have to decide how best we can treat that without doing much impact on the patient.
Right. So actually kidney cancer could be an embracing term for lots of different cancers, lots of different diseases.
Yeah, kidney cancer means cancer that's originated from the kidney. There are some different cell types that start from the kidney, but predominantly, you know, it can be primary kidney cancer confined to the kidney or kidney cancer that has begun to spread beyond the kidney.
All right. So previously, if something like this was found, what would have been done? If it was the traditional treatment?
So the traditional treatment for people that have a small kidney cancer is that they'll be offered really one of two choices. One choice is to watch it and see what it does, because most of these are quite indolent and they'll grow slowly and they may not be a threat to someone's life over the course of several years. So sometimes it will be a case of just observing and see what happens. But lots of people are a bit uncomfortable with that. And the conventional way of treating kidney cancer is to remove it. So either with an operation to remove just the part of the kidney that's got the tumour in it, or in more extreme cases, to remove the whole kidney.
Okay, all right. I can imagine people being quite keen on removal because, that's how most people's mind might work. Get rid of it, get it out.
Yeah, absolutely. And you can understand that, you know, when it's when you're told you've got a tumour inside of you and a doctor says, maybe we won't do much about it and we'll see what it does. That can be unnerving. And people wake up thinking they've got cancer and go to bed thinking they've got cancer, and having it removed seems like a great solution. And it's still a very, very good way of curing that cancer. The difficulty is that we're talking now about tumours that may be only 2, 3, or 4 centimetres in size. And having a relatively big operation to remove something that's quite small is often unnerving. And often we're finding these in patients who are perhaps older and not quite so well, and going to major surgery is a big undertaking for them.
What about radiation treatment? Is that an option?
So traditionally, radiotherapy has not been very good at treating kidney cancer. It's one of those tumour types that doesn't respond very well to radiotherapy. There is some newer radiotherapy, stereotactic radiotherapy, which is much more focused. But the evidence is still a little bit unclear as to whether that's going to be as effective as the other treatment choices we have at the moment.
All right. So that leads on to the question of what's this relatively new method that you want to chat about today?
So this is a process called thermal ablation, which basically means we use heat or cold to destroy tumours. And it's almost always done by someone like me, who's a radiologist, and we use CT scanners or occasionally ultrasound or MRI scanners to help us do the procedure and monitor its effect. So if I describe the way that I do it, I use freezing. So I do it with cryoablation, which means that we put the patient under a general anaesthetic to keep them nice and still inside a CT scanner. And then using the CT scanner, we can very accurately guide thin needle-like probes into the cancer. And at the end of those probes, we can create an ice ball by passing argon gas through the probes. And the ice ball gets down to about minus 140 degrees Celsius. So it's super, super cold. And we can actually see it in the CT scanner. So as the ice ball grows, we can see it in the CT scanner and we can see the tumor. And we can be confident that the ice ball gets bigger than the tumor and destroys it inside of the patient.
Okay. I've can think of quite a few questions straight off. So first of all, the patient is in this big scanner tube. Where are you? Because these scanner tubes are pretty small. There's not enough space for you to get in there and do some delicate work.
Correct. So there are ways in which we combat that. So I'm in the scanner room with the patient, but obviously not physically on the table, stood next to them. So I'll be reaching in with one hand, moving a needle, then doing a quick scan and seeing where the needle is going to make sure it's in the right place.
Okay, so you are sticking your hand in the scanner. So it's your hand holding the needle. It's not a robot.
No, we do have some robotic devices sort of in development, but at the moment the conventional way of doing it and the most straightforward way of doing it is with human hands rather than robot hands.
So you inject a tube in and then you put something down the tube. Say what that was again.
It's a bit like that. They're actually, rather than being tubes, they're actually needles. So they look like very thin, long metal needles that go into the tumor. And then through the center of that needle, we can pass argon gas. And as that gas passes through the tip of the needle, it cools down. It cools the needle down. And that creates the ice ball around the needle or the needles. Normally, okay. We use 3, 4, or 5 of them in a single tumor.
So it only cools down when it gets to the tip of the needle. That's got to be something to do with pressure, force over area or something like that, hasn't it?
Yeah, correct.
Back to physics.
It's the process of cooling is the Joule-Thomson effect, which is the same sort of thing as when you let the air out of your tire and the valve gets cold.
Okay.
So we can use some clever technology to keep that down at the tip of the needle rather than all the way back.
So there must be some high pressure argon gas.
Yeah, this is
going to be injected into people at high pressure, and when the pressure is released, that's when the cooling effect happens.
Yeah, there's a slight nuance there. So the gas never leaves the needle. It never enters the patient. It just passes through a channel in the middle of the needle and then decompresses in a channel on the outside of the needle. So it's never actually leaves the needle itself. So it won't actually enter the patient. But the change in pressure leads to the change in temperature.
All right. I was slightly concerned about potential high pressure being injected into my kidneys or something at high pressure.
So that doesn't happen. It is at very high pressure, but it's all contained within each needle.
Okay. All right. Interesting. All right. So on the way in, it's not cold. It only gets cold or gets really cold at the point of the needle.
Yeah, correct. So the pressure is maintained in this central channel until the tip of the needle, where it decompresses into this outer channel, and it's that change in pressure.
Okay, very good.
Change in temperature.
Very clever. Now, you're saying that these tumours, sometimes quite small, 2 or 3 centimetres across.
Yep.
You need to be a pretty good shot. Tell us about being a good shot and how you monitor what has been made really cold. Because, I mean, that bit, to be honest, sounds a bit scary.
Yeah, so that's where the CT scanner comes in. By keeping the patient under a general anaesthetic, we can control their breathing, which means the kidney doesn't move. So we're not having to hit moving targets, which is the major bonus of the general anaesthetic. And then the CT shows us very precisely where the needles are going. So we can place them and, if need be, move them to a slightly different location. So it's really accurate. You know, we're placing the needles within a couple of millimeters tolerance of where we intend for them to be. And we use several needles because tumors aren't always perfect spheres. They're not always a golf ball. They're sometimes different shapes and configurations. And we can use the multiple probes to make the shape of the ice ball that we're going to need. So almost like ice sculpting inside a patient's kidney.
Okay. Interesting. Now, tumors aren't always kind of hard little... You get the impression that they might be hard little things that you can just pull out, but sometimes they're a bit sort of gloopy.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if that's the case with kidney tumours, but bits might escape.
Yeah, so that's often a concern. So a certain type of kidney tumours are predominantly cystic or fluid inside.
That was the word I was looking for. Gloopy, probably less technical, but yeah, thank you.
But I know exactly what you mean. So so we often get asked that question, what will happen when you put a needle into my cyst or my gloopy tumour? And the truth is that our experience of almost 1,000 cases in Southampton some of which will have been cystic and gloopy, is that we haven't seen them pop and spread. I think, truthfully, I think what happens is that as the needles go through into the cystic part of the tumour, the time between us placing the needles and potentially popping the cyst and turning the machine on to freeze everything is so short that if there are any bits of fluid or cells that seep out, they're immediately caught up in the ice ball. So to our experience so far, we haven't seen that treating more fluid tumours has been a source of locally recurrent disease. In other words, it coming back again in the future.
Okay. And do you very carefully, say the tumour is 2 centimetres, which you can actually measure quite accurately, do you then do this procedure for like 2.2 centimetres, all a little bit further around in the kidney, because you know you want to mop it all up?
Yeah, absolutely right. So it's just like an operation. So a surgeon would take a bit of normal kidney to make sure they've got a safety margin, and we do exactly the same. We know that the edge of the ice that we can see on the CT scanner is at 0 degrees at freezing point, but we need about minus 40 degrees for definite cell death. So we actually have to extend the ice ball about a centimetre beyond the tumour in all directions to make sure that we've done exactly as a surgeon would and mopped up anything else that's around the edge that we haven't quite seen.
I think of freezing things as a way of preserving things normally. Are we absolutely sure that you've got it and killed it rather than just kind of preserved it so it can fight another day?
Yeah, I know what you're thinking. But then you could look at it in the other direction and say, we've all seen pictures of frostbite and people's fingers going black and falling off and being dead. And again, that's freezing. And now the temperatures that we're using down to minus 140 degrees Celsius are at a point
that's
where it can survive. And we've been doing, whilst this is relatively new nationally, we've been doing it in Southampton since 2008. So we do have a significant time now to know that actually this is a sustainable treatment in almost everybody that we treat.
All right. Interesting. So you end up with a load of dead cancer cells. They've been frozen to death. They're just going to stay there? Aren't they going to kind of rot?
Well, they do. I mean, it's so you end up with a, as you say, a dead area in the kidney where the tumor used to be. All the little blood vessels have been killed off. All the cells are dead. And effectively, your body works it away and it ends up being a scar. So we monitor people with scans a month, a year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years after their treatment. And we just see that area of the kidney scars down. So the body works away the dead tissue. Nothing is passed in your urine or anything. Nothing is removed. Your body works it away into a small scar. So we can see where the treatment happened. Okay. And that's useful because we can monitor to see whether there's any chance of it coming back.
So do you end up with kind of a 2 centimetre gap with scar tissue around the end, around the sides? Because nature likes to fill up a hole, doesn't it? You can't just get or do you get a hole?
Well, effectively, you get a hole. It looks like there's been a little divot taken out of the kidney, much as you would with an operation, which is, as I say, it's useful for us to be able to monitor and know that the treatment's still been successful.
Actually, I've often wondered that. I mean, because I'm not a medical person, as you've probably figured out. But, you know, I've thought, OK, if you take a kidney out, that's kind of a big gap you're leaving. Does something try and get in the gap, or you just end up with a hole?
So, yeah, if you remove the whole kidney, then the other bits that are inside your body will flop into that space where it used to be. Okay. The areas we're treating are much, much smaller in the kidney, and it really doesn't make too much difference. There's nothing that needs to fill the gap.
Okay, interesting. What about recovery rates? Because you mentioned already if older people have major surgery and, you know, work on a kidney, getting to it, you know, cutting your way in, cutting a thing out. This is major surgery, something to be avoided if you can. However, you're still under a general anaesthetic during this procedure, probably for quite a long time. It sounds almost as dramatic as surgery.
Yeah. So the truth is that lots of people that have this procedure...
We only deal with the truth on this program, Alex, by the way. I like it when you say that.
Good. We know that lots of patients that we treat will simply have no discomfort or pain afterwards. Many patients can go home the same day. depending on the complexity of their tumour and the treatment that they've had. The vast majority will have very little discomfort and within 48 or 72 hours are back to normal. Most will stay for one night or go home the same day. And there's a phrase that my surgical colleagues use when they're talking to patients about surgery or cryoablation. And they tell them that recovery with surgery will be measured in days and weeks, but with cryoablation, it would be measured in hours and days. And that's the truth. And that's really appealing for patients that actually, you know, they'll be in and out of hospital probably within 24 hours and back to their normal life within a very short period.
Yeah, I mean, and that's good for everyone as well. That's good for the hospital. You know, you don't need patients hanging around getting in the way, do you? Get them home.
Well, exactly. There's a huge drive to get people back out of hospital and into the community. And this is one way in which we've proven that it's safe and effective to do.
Yeah. So you've been through the process and it seems like there are lots of positives. Any negatives? I mean, do the any chance of the cancer sort of roving around the body and popping up somewhere else? Because I know that's a potential with surgery.
Yeah, so we don't really have experience that patients are more likely to get metastatic disease. You know, in other words, it roving around the body depending on having this treatment. There's a general consensus that the success rates for freezing and for surgery are both absolutely excellent for curing cancer. You know, well in excess of 95% across the world. Surgery is probably still better as a cancer cure in absolute terms, but the difference is 2 or 3%. So for many people, the advantages of quicker recovery, maintaining a better kidney function, being home the same day or the next day, they're willing to take that chance of maybe 2 or 3% lower success rate for something that's still probably 95% success rate. So there's no real chance from what we've seen of this initiating a spread of cancer. And actually, the truth is that because this is so straightforward, we can repeat it. So in the very few patients that need a second treatment, it's really easy to do. Oh. But with an operation, a second operation is obviously much, much harder than the first one because of all the scar tissue and the events that have happened before.
So I must admit, when I was just preparing for this interview, I thought, well, this sounds too good to be true. Why isn't it used on other tumours in other parts of the body?
So it is.
It is. Okay.
Yeah.
No. Tell me.
So I treat liver cancers as well. We don't freeze those. We heat them up, but it's exactly the same process. I treat some prostate cancers, as do a lot of urological surgeons now with freezing or with heating. We treat some bone tumours. We treat lung tumours. With all sort of different things that pop up, we're able to do exactly the same process for in the CT scanner and with a short hospital stay of probably one night. So it's much more widespread than just small kidney cancers.
So is this the way ahead? Are we going to be hearing a lot more about this kind of thing?
Well, I hope so. I think as these procedures are maturing and we're getting more data, there's a general acceptance that, well, if there is a cost saving to the NHS and there's a recovery benefit for the patient without a huge drop in kidney cancer rate, cure rates, then actually this is, as you say, this could be seen as a win-win for most people.
Very interesting. All right. So if people are listening to this and they, well, maybe they're suffering from cancer or they've just been diagnosed, certainly with kidney cancer, and they want to find out more, potentially, you know, get this treatment, what can they do?
Well, the most important thing they can do is go and ask their urological surgeon if it's kidney cancer and say, what are the options for ablation? For some patients, it simply won't be an appropriate treatment. Unfortunately, for a lot of patients across the UK, it's never mentioned to them because they don't have it available locally. But that shouldn't stop patients asking and saying, is it an option for me? Could I seek that treatment out? With the new NICE guidance on kidney cancer being released, there will be some information there, and there are other sources on the internet to check. But I would advocate going to your surgeon or your doctor and saying, could this be an option for me?
Okay. And what about if people are just interested and want to, you know, find out a little bit more than just our little chat? Any good sources of information? You know, the NHS website is often very good on all sorts of things, but something like that, where can you point people?
So there's also information on the British Association of Urological Surgeons website. So the society that represents urologists in the UK and other similar societies across Europe and the world will have information available. A simple Google search will often bring up the patient information leaflets that people like me will give to a patient, which will have direct data and, you know, what to expect when you come for the treatment and how it will feel afterwards.
Excellent. All right. Well, look, this is all very interesting. So thank you very much, Dr. King, for taking the time to chat.
My pleasure. It's been great fun.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show. They were Fiona Loud, Policy Director at Kidney Care UK, talking about kidney health in general, and Dr. Alex King, Consultant Radiologist, talking about a way to treat kidney cancer. Thank you to you for listening, and have a healthy week. Until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Sarah wasn't bad at her job, she was stuck in hidden grief. After her dog died, she took a sales role just to stay busy, but every pitch felt empty. A Cogna Movement session uncovered that she was seeking the warmth of her dog rather than serving her clients. Using our patented movement and sensory patterns, she cleared the grief and rocketed to the top. What hidden emotion is holding you back? Try our Essentials program at the special UK Health Radio rate. Visit cognamovement.com/radio or click on the Cogna Movement banner on the UK Health Radio homepage. Results vary.
What if your healing journey could feel empowering, hopeful, even transformative? Welcome to the Alkaline Collective Mastermind, a community for anyone facing cancer, staying cancer-free, or committed to prevention. No matter your stage, whether you've chosen conventional care, an integrative path, or a fully holistic approach, here, you're not alone. Here, your healing journey becomes a journey of empowerment. We explore the science of oxygenation, metabolism, and alkalinity, while strengthening your emotional, spiritual, and physical well-being. This is a mastermind with heart, accountability, connection, wisdom, and real support. Because your journey isn't just about surviving. It's about thriving. Join us by clicking on the Alkaline Collective Mastermind banner on the UK Health Radio homepage or directly at alkaline-collective.com, where self-belief grows, healing deepens, and transformation begins.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.